Hello! Today's mini-episode is a conversation with Dr. Jill L. Crichton, a higher education professional and the host of SA Voices from the Field podcast. She came to talk with us about her experience as a transracial adoptee and how she would like to see adoption represented on film and television.
Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that the lands from which we recorded this podcast and from where you are listening are part of territories that have long served as a gathering place for diverse Indigenous peoples, and we are thankful, as guests on this land, to be able to live, work, and gather here together. We continue to learn about the history that came before us and encourage you to do the same.
Quick reminder to our listeners that this interview should not be taken as medical advice and it is for informational purposes only. Because everyone's brain is different, please consult your healthcare professional if you have any questions.
Hello, Jill, and welcome to Brains.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us a little about yourself and what you do?
That is an incredibly complex question.
Yes.
Identity is something that I spend a lot of time thinking about on a daily basis because of the population of human beings that I spend my time with and how we define identity and what that means and how we choose to put certain identities forward first or not, depending on the environment. So I host another podcast for my profession. And so I was realizing as I was sitting down to the mic that my lens for this conversation needs to be extremely different than my normal lens for my podcasting space. And I'm in my regular podcasting chair with my regular podcasting headphones on. So it's kind of interesting to have to shift my ontology in the framework from which I talk about this. So I guess the first answer is I'm a professional podcaster. I host a podcast called Student Affairs Voices from the Field, which is hosted through a U.S.-based 501c3 nonprofit called NASPA, which is a 501c3 that supports higher education and student affairs professionals. So that's kind of how I got my start with this big fancy microphone. I think my second identity right now would probably be as an expat and figuring out what that means and what life looks like and what joy looks like in these spaces. But I'm also a hobbyist musician. I'm a partner. I'm a traveler. I think first in my personal life, I'm a partner and second a traveler for sure. I'm a sister. I'm a daughter. I'm a person who values friends and deep relationships. I'm not a huge fan of small talk, but I'm also...
Hello.
Becoming keenly aware in my expat life that I'm super American, way more than I thought I was, even though I think of myself as a very global human. I'm also dual citizen. So many, many layers to the question of who you are, but I think that's where I'd start.
Amazing.
Oh, I love that.
I will say one of the things that I am finding joyous about Jill being abroad is that she is trying all the different flavors of Oreos where she is. And I really am enjoying the flavors that I don't have to try. So thank you for sharing that content.
Well, you'll have to share your handle so everybody can follow along and know which Oreos to avoid.
Pro tip, do not eat the rice wine Oreos and the peach grape Oreos. Also not my jam.
Interesting.
But the vanilla bean Oreos you can't get in the US. Those are amazing. And the mango Oreo was pretty good.
Can you tell us a little bit about your adoption story, however much you feel comfortable sharing?
Sure. So let me recenter that with the identity-based answer first, which is one of my identities is as a transracial adoptee. So my transracial identity is as a transracial Korean-American adoptee. So what that means is that I was born in Korea. I was adopted as an infant to my parents in the United States. My parents are both white identified. My father comes from an Irish, English, French genetic heritage, and my mother comes from a Scandinavian genetic heritage, Norwegian. So if I were a biological product of my parents, I'd probably be a very small blonde person, but I am not. And so my brother and I actually are both transracial adoptees. And that means that culturally and ethnically, although born not in that context, that's the context that is my family and my home and my identity. And transracial identity is one of the most complex and unexplored identities in academic literature. It's unexplored in terms of racial bias. It's unexplored in terms of inclusion, in terms of the mainstream. Now, there are some amazing scholars doing good work in this area, but it's not something that has made its way into the zeitgeist in terms of real dialogue, other than people co-opting the term and actually creating more confusion for the general public. But transracial identity is something that is so complex that we don't have the language to talk about it in a lot of places in our lives. And most transracial people experience discrimination based on their perceived identity, both by the identity that they're quote unquote supposed to be perceived as, and as the identity that we actually identify through. And so those spaces mean that we are actually more closely aligned with multiracial people in terms of our daily experiences than we are with kind of monolithic identity.
One of the things I know we've talked about around adoption before is just like, we always try to look at the positive spin, but really the misrepresentation, I think, on television and film and beyond that. I asked the question, like, is anyone getting it right? I feel like the answer is no, but I'd love to have your thoughts on, like, you know, how do you think of what we're seeing right now in terms of, like, as you said earlier, not even scholars are talking about your adoption experience, but then even just adoption experience across the board. I feel like, you know, it's like a very complicated subject, but, you know, what do you think about what we're seeing right now?
The number one pet peeve of mine in adoption stories being told in mainstream media, and this is typically fictionalized, written narrative, TV and movies, is the heroism angle on adoption. Almost all adoption stories are told through the lens of the parent, not through the child. And the lens of the parent is that I'm saving this baby from a terrible fate. And it's actually, the saviorism is just frustrating. It's misrepresenting, and it really makes me quite angry when I see those stories being told, because it does the story dirty. It's the only way to put it. I know several other adoptees who share feelings in this space, who wonder when representation will come to screen. And part of that is that writers who are writing adoption stories don't know anything about adoption. And that is hugely problematic in media. It's kind of the exact same problems that we replicated from white writers writing Black stories, or having straight writers write LGBT stories without having any of these contextual elements. So whenever you have a person of majority identity who is completely naive, or rising to the top of the Dunning-Kruger Mount stupid, writing for these populations that don't know anything about what it's like to be a person, a member of that identity, you get stories that are misrepresenting, you get stories that are inaccurate, and you get stories that are really designed to make the receiver of those stories feel good. So, like, The Blind Side is one of the worst offenders. Michael Orr's story, he's adopted by the character Sandra Bullock plays. I can't remember her name, Leanne Tui, maybe. And that is a transracial adoption story, technically. Michael Orr's adopted in a teenage era of his life, almost adulthood. And, you know, the way that the writers frame that story for The Blind Side is that they saved him. And if you listen to Michael Orr talk about his story now, he would never tell you that he was saved. And so it's just an interesting twist. We also see this happen really anytime you see a blended family on TV that way. I've only seen maybe one or two shows actually attempt to be honest with adoption stories. One of them is because it's not mentioned, actually. There's a film from the mid-2000s called Dan in Real Life. That's when Steve Carell is starting to break into drama. It's almost like a bottle movie. It takes place all in this cabin for the most part, or this lake house. And one of the characters, I think that's a sibling of Steve Carell's character, has a transracial adopted daughter, and they don't talk about her identity. They don't talk about the fact that she's adopted. She's just in their family, which is how my experience was. That's just my family. And so one of the other things that bothers me about narratives around adoption is that it has to be made a big deal of all the time. And in families that are truly integrated, and I use that word, I know that's a very loaded word. I use that word fairly intentionally in this case, but that have done the work of blending the family well, it's not a topic of regular conversation, because that only serves to alienate the child.
Yeah.
Or to serve as a heroism story for the parent. Now, the other side of this is that the adoptee community and the social work community and the foster community, so even in non-transracial adoption stories where you might place a person of a perceived race with a family of that same perceived race, those stories are also riddled with challenges in mainstream media. Mm-hmm. Those stories, though, real people who actually live that life. There's a lot of neglect. There's a lot of abuse. There's a lot of manipulation of the system. And so the reality for people that are adopted of any identity to a family of any identity, there's a higher risk for adverse childhood experiences or ACEs. The one thing to center here is that for many adoptees, this is not a generalized overall statement, but for many adoptees, the adoption itself is a traumatic childhood event. And I'm not saying we should go the other way and dramatize stories of trauma. We have a lot of that in media as well, but there's not really been a great accurate portrayal that I've seen. But the one that has probably tried the best is actually Shonda Rhimes. There's a story in Grey's Anatomy. There's a character named Maggie, who is actually like the biological child of Richard and Ellis, for those of you who stuck around with Grey's like more than five seasons.
It's very long now.
She's adopted to a family that's just her family. And that for me was a more healthy portrayal. And she's choosing whether or not to discover a connection with the biological identity that she carries. But for many adoptees, there's a language piece that also I find just absolutely infuriating, which is, oh, your real parents. That is so insulting. It is incredibly insulting, not only to me as a human, to my parents, and to the biological parental lineage that I carry with me. It's insulting to everybody. So if any of you are doing social justice work with language changes in your life, please never say your real parents to a person who is of adopted descent. You could use the term biological parents. That's accurate. But for me, I refer to my parents just as my parents and the people who I have genetic lineage from as my biological parents. Or some people will even be more pejorative and say egg donor, sperm donor. But that's really up to that person to claim their own language. But as a person who was not adopted, please, please never say, quote unquote, your real parents to somebody. It is deeply offensive.
My question after that, like, what kind of representation? You've talked a little bit about it throughout, but what kind of representation would you like to see?
I would like to see representation that is complex, because there is no, so the adoptee community is spoken about as a monolith, but no two stories are alike. Mm-hmm. We as society, especially in Western and American Canadian society, have a tendency to really try to force people to fit inside of a box. And those narratives come out of that box. You know, if you go back to the history of comedy, there's something like, you know, only allegedly seven kinds of comedy. And so then all of those comedies fit into those seven boxes, but it doesn't leave room for thinking outside of those boxes. So I would love to see a story that represents somebody where their adoption story is not about their trauma or not about the heroism of the people that adopted them. There are a lot of people for whom adoption is part of their identity, but it's not their first or forward identity. But it's a component that all of us bring to the table every day in different ways. And it could be something that is something that creates pride. It could be something that creates shame. It could be something that creates anxiety or fear. Or it could be also a space for people that is full of joy, depending on their own story or their blended story. So I would like to see somebody really try to capture the authenticity of someone else's adoption story outside of a documentary. Now, there are plenty of good documentaries about the adoption stories or the roots tracing stories of adoptees. But this is another thing I'll go back to, actually, which is there's... So if you're not in the trauma or you're not in the heroism, you're in the quote unquote finding your roots story, which forces adoptees to believe that their only way to being a whole person is to quote unquote figure out where they came from. And that is not a true narrative for all people, especially all adopted people. And so I would love to see that be broken and really figure out where else that can be. There are a couple of celebrities right now who have transracial adoptee identity that are doing really well in Hollywood. Lana Condor, I'll give a shout out to her. She's a transracial Vietnamese adoptee, as far as I know. She was in To All the Boys I Loved Before, and she just had a movie with one of the Sweet Life twins. The Sprouse is Dylan and Cody.
Dylan and Cole.
Cole. There we go. We got there. Well, one of them just did... moonshot, I think, with Lana Condor. So she's out there, you know, making a name for herself and doing well as an actor. And then also one of the Top Chef winners recently, Kristen, her last name is going to escape me right now, but Kristen from Top Chef, she is a Korean adoptee as well, transracial Korean adoptee. And she has told her story in various ways. But her first identity is as a chef, at least her public identity is as a chef. So allowing for people to be themselves first is part of what I'd like to see in those representative stories. And I'd love to see more transracial adoptees in writing rooms actually telling those stories in a way that is not intended to represent everyone with a similar background. We do a lot of that kind of pedestal thinking where this person's story is supposed to represent all people with this story.
Yes.
And that doesn't allow for the complexity of humanity. And these are the exact same problems that we're repeating with other people of marginalized identities.
Yes.
So it's not new.
Every person we speak with on our podcast says we're not a monolith. And it's like, it's very apparent to people in marginalized communities, but yet our media and entertainment is not catching up to that.
Well, what happens too is, like, I was just talking to a showrunner today, and the pressure that sometimes they're like, well, we want to have a room with different people from different experiences, but we only have five people we can have in the room, or four people can have the room. And then you can't capture all the experiences. And then what happens is, you know, there was an amazing show called Porter that was at CBC. It was a completely black writing room. It was a story about black porters in Canada. And there people were like, oh, thank God, for the first time I get to just be myself. And I don't have to represent suddenly all the people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I feel like that happens a lot. You're in a room and you only get to write that story instead of being able to say, no, there's pieces of my experiences that are human that belong to all the characters. And I'm not just here to write one. Whereas you as a showrunner get to write everybody.
Tokenism is not a solution to your diversity problem, right? And I think that's what we see in corporate boardrooms. We see that tokenism play out for people, any person who's ever lived on the margins of society. And I'm stealing that quote from Dr. Sumi Pendicor. I just had a conversation with her on my show about what living in America as a brown woman is like right now. So when we see that tokenism play out, it means that you still are actually creating an oppressive environment for your writers.
Yes.
It still means that people are fighting to be heard for whatever mystical reason that you're creating. And it also means that you're not going to have the complexity of the human story. And if your people in the room of whatever marginalized identity you've chosen them to fill, do not get the opportunity to be broad thinkers, you're missing out, and you're forcing them to explain why they are marginalized on repeat. And so it actually becomes bigger labor than people of those majority identities probably are aware of. And there's another great quote that I can't remember who it's attributed to now, but somebody said, why do people of color or people from marginalized identities have to make a spectacle of our pain in order to be heard? And that is a consistent message in Hollywood.
Yes, when you create those spaces that, you know, we're going to tell this story, and the story's being led by the person that this story is supposed to be reflective of, versus it being like, come and, you know, we just want your trauma. Or a lot of people think if to get into a program at any of the studios, you have to give all your trauma, because it feels like that is what they're asking for in their
questions.
That's
what it's, mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's what it seems like in every mm-hmm. application. It's like, why are you unique? Tell me about what terrible things happened in your life.
Yeah, let me just please disclose all of your private details.
Yeah.
So I can decide if your trauma is worthy of my space.
How wild is that?
Weird way to frame things.
Yes. 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 And it's as long as you're okay, as long as you're not in your trauma space, though. Like, right, you could have had trauma, but now you're okay.
Yeah, so yeah, just you like, can't be still dealing with it.
Yes. You have to have been damaged, but you
but
can't
healed.
Be damaged now.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes. I'll also throw out a Marcus Harvey Green quote. He was a writer for the Seattle Times when I saw this. I actually don't know what he's doing now. But he said something to the effect of, there's a substantial difference between all are welcome here, and this was made with you in mind. And I think we are always working towards the latter and we're not very successful at it. And so when we talk about stories of inclusion or processes of storytelling that are resulting in inclusion, I think we're still kind of stuck in the, we believe all are welcome here. Why don't you feel welcome?
Yes.
Versus we intentionally created and curated an environment where voices are honored, where people are welcome to share their experiences. One of my most recent favorite films actually is an animated feature from Pixar called Turning Red. And it was a great Chinese Canadian story of a young girl growing up. That was one of Pixar's first films ever fully ran by a woman of color. Actually, it might be the first. And her name is Domi Lee. And Domi was just touted by all of the creators that she worked with for creating one of the most inclusive sets ever. That they'd ever worked on. And so we also see different ways of leading when we invite voices that haven't had a chance to be in the front of the room. And also, does leadership have to be in the front of the room? That's a very Western patriarchal model of leadership. And so there's a question to me too, is what does it look like when we work from a more restorative place or a more circular leadership or domain-based leadership place?
Yes. I was just talking with my daughter and my husband today about what makes a good leader. And so it's just funny that you bring this all up and we're talking about, you know, leaders help other people grow and get better and you're helping the group to do the best thing. And it's not about who's telling who, because she's like, everybody's so bossy. But anyway, it was just like an interesting way that my husband brought up in explaining what a leader is, because he's a leader in his role at work, and that it's about him making sure his staff is able to do the best. And I think that is making an inclusive environment so people feel comfortable. I think the environments that we create on set, and I've experienced that with some of my, you know, people I've worked with in my world as an editor and working with marginalized folks as directors, I always have a different experience than working with the typical, what was once the majority of all directors, right? It's just a different environment completely. And it's so night and day sometimes. It's wild.
And I want to clarify too, I've never worked professionally in film or television, but I'm an avid consumer of pop culture. When I was writing my doctoral dissertation, I started taking breaks by reading and consuming entertainment, quote unquote, news, because it was the exact opposite of doctoral research. And then I kind of got sucked in from there.
Yeah, sometimes it's, I'm like, fun. Is this an article? But that's okay. Like, what is this? I'm like, this is a press release. This is a press release.
Or that is a sentence. That is definitely a sentence. It's definitely
one sentence. What am I learning?
Now, you mentioned, Kristen, I think it's Kish, because you shared a really great article.
Yeah, the Top Chef winner. Thank you.
Yes, Kish. Yes. And you shared a great article with me. Or not, sorry, I said article, but it was a Facebook post, because she went back to, she returned to Korea for the first time since she was adopted. And I think you'd said at the time that you felt like it was maybe one of the first mainstream and authentic adoption stories of that, like of that experience. And so how did seeing that story or the potential of that story make you feel? You know, what do you hope comes from that?
So as far as I know, it hasn't come out yet, or maybe I just super missed it. But that at the same time, it was pandemic era, right? So pandemic era when this got announced, and we all know that projects got picked up and dropped a lot in that period of time. So I'm not really sure if this will ever come to fruition at this point, or if it did and they're in editing or whatever. The story, what I meant by that was, we don't see a lot of authentic adoption stories in mainstream. We, again, see it in the documentary space quite a bit. We see it in the independent space a lot, but we haven't really seen it picked up by a giant like Netflix.
Yeah.
So I was excited to see that the giant decided to care about this story more than anything. Now, I don't know Kristen Kish personally, and I don't know a ton about her other than what she has chosen to put out in the media. I also know that, you know, like all humans, we are all very flawed. And there are some people that really resent her for doing this in the adoptee community. I'm more of the mind of go get yours. Somebody's going to pay for you to do this and you want to do it. Take the money and go.
Yeah.
But there are others who say that it won't be authentic because it's being produced by an entertainment giant. So I think there's people that have thoughts about this that are strong on both sides, but until we see the product, and to be fair, maybe it came out and I missed it. I want to acknowledge that too. And if it did come out, I'll go back and find it.
Yeah, I didn't see anything. That's why I was like, I just thought I haven't seen anything yet. So,
but I'm excited, like I said, that a mainstream entertainment mega giant at this point really mm-hmm. has decided to frame this as important for their narratives and the stories that they want to tell, because that's an indicator to me that maybe the tide will shift a little bit and we'll be seeing more stories like that. Because really, when we talk about quote unquote diverse stories in media today, the conversation really began as white and black stories. Mm-hmm. We did not see the inclusion of people of other racial identities in those stories. And we also did not see people coming to the forefront with stories of multiracial identity. And this is just in the kind of marginalized protected class of racial identity. We're still missing these stories in ethnic identity. We're missing these stories in disability story, in, you know, you name it. Women's stories are still weird. I just saw an analysis too about Oscar winning movies and how much women speak in them.
I saw that graph.
Yeah, that graph. And it was so intense because I think women spoke the most like 30% of the time in Oscar winning movies. And it just shows us implicitly what bias looks like. So I think for me, as we started this conversation centering on adoption narratives in media, ultimately, you can have the exact same conversation about most marginalized identities in any industry. And the conversation probably sounds pretty similar. Mm-hmm. The needs are the same, right? The needs are that people of marginalized identities need allies to speak up, because the labor cannot always fall on the person who's experiencing the marginalization. We need allies to do their own work and research and not put the labor on the backs again of the people that are experiencing that marginalization or oppression. And we also need people to see each other as complex human beings and really from an intersectional space. If you've never read Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, she's really the person that coined that term. And the idea is that in society, because we like labels, boxes, and organizations so much, we only allow people to wear one identity at a time. And Dr. Crenshaw's work really calls on us to say, don't make me choose, because I don't divide those things from my own being. So you don't get to divide them for me. You don't get to choose who I am. First and foremost, I choose that for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I like that
a lot. And I think too, this idea, again, like we kind of circled that of like being the sole person for, or being only seen with the lens of here's the one trait, like that idea, like you are more than, there's intersectionality in us and we can't separate those things. But we spoke on an earlier podcast with a wonderful woman who has cerebral palsy. And she said, the best day of my life was when my nephews were born. And the worst day in my life was when my friend died. Those have nothing to do with my disability.
Mm-hmm.
And she like, that's the story. Those are the stories I want to tell. That's what mm-hmm. I want to see represented. Like you even said earlier, when we're talking about adoption stories, adoption doesn't have to be front and center. People can be adopted and exist in the world. And those are the stories. And through the mm-hmm. lens, it's one lens that they have, one language, but it's not all of the languages.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean you don't include that component of the narrative. It just means that it can be an element.
Yes.
It doesn't always have to be the focus. Like if you're featuring an adopted character in your story, their adoption does not have to be the only thing that that character is about.
Now, I realize that we are getting closer our time with you. So what is one thing that you'd like people to take away when they're thinking about the impact of adoption?
I'll maybe get three things. One, saviorism, heroism stories of the parents are trash. Stop telling them. Two, do your own work on the narratives of people of all marginalized identities and don't try to represent them without them, or don't try to represent us without us, depending on what identity you're talking about. And the third is if you get to be the leader of those spaces, do your work to understand what tokenism is and how you might be perpetuating that in the spaces that you have control over.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Where can people listen to your podcast, find out more about you, follow you, whatever you'd like to share with our listeners? Go
sure.
For it.
My podcast is called SA Voices from the Field. SA stands for Student Affairs. It is very niche and specific to my profession. So if you are not a higher education administrator, probably will not be at all interesting or meaningful to you, but hey, come check us out. And then you can find me on LinkedIn, Dr. Jill L. Creighton.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Jill, for coming on and just enlightening us with so much amazing information. And please, if you're in higher education, Jill is the bomb. So please listen to her.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me on.
Brains is hosted and produced by Heather and Sarah Taylor. And our theme song is by our little brother, Deafish.
If you like what you hear, please rate and review us and tell your friends to tune in. You can reach us on Instagram, TikTok, or Twitter at Brains Podcast, spelled BRAAINS Podcast. You can also go to our website, brainspodcast.com, where you can contact us, subscribe, and find out a little more about who we are and what we do.